Today is December 17th, 2014. This is episode number 285 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, apologizer in chief. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. I did that upspeak thing again.
Yes. Yes, you did.
I don't know why I do that. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Yeah, the upspeak thing. What's up with that?
I don't know. I can apologize for that, too. But the real thing that I'm apologizing for is all the noise from last week's episode.
See, the problem is that, the box that Brian stuck the interns in. I forgot to pull it out of the studio. I mean, really, it could happen to anyone. You understand.
It could happen to anyone, but I do apologize for the knocking noise that was going on in the background. And last week's show got a couple of complaints about it. And, you know, we pride ourselves in the audio quality of our show. We actually go to great lengths to provide the best quality we can, and it really, really annoyed me to have to put that out, and I apologize.
Well, I can think
of... And it was my fault, by the way. Definitely wasn't Jeff's fault.
Well, and regardless, I can think of far worse issues for us to have, like getting to the end of the show and losing the audio files.
We've done that.
We've done that. See, that was worse.
But that tends to not, like, annoy anyone else because they don't know.
Well, eventually they do.
Yeah, eventually they do, yeah. Yeah, the knocking thing really annoyed some people. So anyway, if you're still with us, if you're giving us another shot, I appreciate it. We've done hundreds of shows with good high quality. That's what our goal is.
That's right. And if you hear any knocking today, just blame it on Brian.
Yeah.
Even if it's me forgetting there's a microphone in my face and yes, bouncing my glasses off of it.
Yeah, you've done that a couple times today.
I know. Some days I just have this problem where I totally forget that the microphone is this close to my face and I just bounce right off of it.
Now, you know who else has a problem with microphones and bouncing their faces off of them?
Oh, do tell.
Let's see. Let me pick a topic.
But you need a three-sided die.
I do. But actually, let's start with the iPod suit because it seems like the plaintiffs for the class action suit against Apple, it seems like those attorneys might be the kinds of folks who do have problems not bouncing their faces off microphones.
Well, to be fair, the it was the law firm of Larry Curly and Moe. I mean, it had to have been.
It had to have been. So yesterday, verdict came out. The jury found Apple not guilty of blah, 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 monopoly, iPod, iTunes, evil stuff.
Right. So to translate back to normal human speak from what Brian just said, this is the case that started several years ago. See, that counts as several, mm-hmm. Where Apple was accused of using their control over the music market and the portable music player market to keep competitors from getting a foothold. Specifically, they would not allow companies like Real to load music onto the iPod. And when companies figured hacks to work around that, Apple would then update their software to block the hack and remove the songs that were loaded on through said hacks.
Now, so many interesting things about this. First of all, Apple argued in court that its system was no different than, say, the Xbox or the PlayStation from Sony, where buying content for one ecosystem or the other, no one has an expectation that content will work on a competing ecosystem.
Right.
That was Apple's argument. Apparently, that was a fairly successful argument. But then we have like I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
I was going to say it was a very successful argument, but I don't think Apple even needed to make it. I really believe the plaintiffs did everything in their power, whether they intended to or not, to basically give the case to Apple.
Well, you know, in their defense.
I think that's a better angle to take.
We have, goodness gracious. You know, you see advertisements on the old TV occasionally for, you know, attorneys who are looking for victims for a class action suit.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain class of law firm that exists only to start class actions, find plaintiffs, or, you know, when a problem erupts somewhere, to gather some people that problem has affected and put together a class action suit, you know, one or the other. So there's a class of attorney who exist only to do that. And largely, I don't know, bottom dwelling scum suckers, generally speaking. And the problem with saying something like that is that class action suits actually represent an important protection for consumers.
Yes, the problem is when people decide they want to abuse the system,
right,
and use the courts just as a financial gain tool for themselves.
It's like medical malpractice. Being able to sue a doctor for negligence, for malpractice, is an extremely important protection for consumers. But it gets abused because people see it just as an opportunity to get some money, just because, or people, you know, can't accept that that something didn't go perfectly for them. You know, I mean, it gets abused, but it's still, the underlying principle is extremely important.
It is. And you see very similar abuse in the patent system. I mean, patents are important,
yeah,
but there are businesses out there that have created their entire business plan or business model on abusing the patent system.
You know, it's interesting. This is I'm going to take us way off the rails.
All right.
I'm reading The Innovators by Walter Isaacson.
Okay.
And I've been reading it. I'm reading it pretty slowly. I've got a lot of stuff going on in my life right now.
So you're reading it basically the way I read a book.
Yes, which is not normally the way I read a book.
So
normally,
now you have a better understanding into my life. Let's hug.
No.
Oh.
Read your books faster. Anyway, Walter Isaacson. Now, most of our listeners will know him best from his Steve Jobs biography. But he also, before he did the Steve Jobs biography, he did a killer biography on Franklin. I think he did Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say he did John Adams too. And he's an excellent biographer. And it's not because he's like the best writer ever. His research is just astounding. And he is excellent at finding little ways to contextualize people's lives. And as we all know, I happen to obsess over context.
I had not picked up on that.
Yeah, I'm sure you hadn't. So Walter, I think he did a terrific job on the Steve Jobs biography. An amazing job. I have not read a complaint about the Steve Jobs biography that I have found credible, to be honest. To be as extremely blunt as I can. The only legitimate complaint about the Steve Jobs biography that I have seen is that he actually showed us some of the bad sides of Steve Jobs along with the good side, and people who want to canonize Steve Jobs didn't like that.
You know, I have a confession.
Mm-hmm.
I never finished reading the book.
Ah, fair enough.
I didn't even make it a third of the way through. And it, I have no complaint about the book per se. I just simply lost interest in it.
Hmm. I thought it was terrific. I gobbled it up.
And I'm glad that you did, because it brought some entertainment and some enjoyment to your life. So that's great.
That's so polite. That's such a polite F you.
No, there's no F you there, really. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I lost interest at the repetitive nature of the early part of the book, where it talked about how Steve Jobs cried to manipulate people, and he smelled bad.
But man, that's important stuff.
It was very important stuff.
It's context.
And yes, it was important context. It just reached a point where I lost interest.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And that, so, yeah, that was it. But anyhow.
The Innovators is his newish book. It came out about a month ago, and I'm still reading it. And it looks at the birth of the computing industry, and it actually starts with Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace, who was a noblewoman in England who actually did a bunch of theoretical work for him and explored some of the earliest concepts of programming. I didn't even know that this woman existed. Don't get me wrong. A lot of people knew that she existed. A lot of people know all about her. She's held up as a female mathematician in an age when there weren't that many female mathematicians and scientists. And anyway, fascinating story.
Yeah, I find her to be an inspiration for all people. Not just like women. And girls, look what you are capable of, but just like people, look what you are capable of. I mean, she was an amazing person.
She did some amazing things, yeah. And so it starts there, and you know, it looks at other developments along the way. But the book is really about the nature of innovation. And even though I'm only about halfway through it, to be honest, I haven't gotten to I'm right on the cusp of the Apple era, as a matter of fact. I know that Steve Jobs does figure prominently in the book. But one of the things that Walter Isaacson is laying out is the fact that innovation is not the realm of a solo genius in a garage somewhere. In fact, most of the time when solo geniuses in garages have come up with something fantastic, even, for instance, Charles Babbage, who worked with Ada Lovelace but did not have a team around him, his innovations went nowhere. You know, they were referred back to over the decades and centuries since, but he himself did not actually accomplish anything with his difference engine and his analytical engine. And the times that we do see these massive leaps in innovation are when people with vision are surrounded by teams that can help execute and add to that vision. That's the theme. That's the theme of the book. And another theme of the book, something that we've been exploring, is the way the open nature of early computer development in the 50s. Led to the internet, how it led to the internet, and how that openness was key to the internet becoming what it is today. And all of this is to say that what we have right now is, you know, the only folks that are really interested in open development is, of course, the open source movement, and that's relatively in a niche market. And you've got companies like, you know, Apple and Intel and Microsoft and Google and Facebook and you know, all the other tech giants of today who are all busy patenting stuff instead of doing open development. And it's an interesting contrast.
Yes, it is. You know, and I find it interesting that that companies like Apple do also feed into the whole open source thing some.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. That is true. But I think our longtime listeners will know that both you and I are very tense with the idea that the Android ecosystem largely got off the ground by copying Apple's innovations.
Yes. Yes.
And while Android itself and even handset makers like Samsung, the copyist copier of them all, are not currently copying Apple designs, Android would not have gotten off the ground if it had not copied iOS. If it had not copied all of those things that Apple risked so much to develop. And you and I are tense about that, right?
A wee bit, yes.
But one of the arguments that I've heard against people like me, from someone I actually respect, is that when a company like Apple comes up with a new way of doing something, humanity is best served by other people being able to use those same innovations and building on them and making something new.
That is true, but there's a very fine line between taking someone else's innovation and using it as inspiration for your own innovation and just simply copying or stealing what someone else is doing.
Yeah, Apple, it took Apple a lot of work to make Pinch and Zoom work, to make it function. It took Apple a lot of work to find exactly how the slide to unlock concept worked best. And then, other companies just ripped that stuff. I don't know. It's so interesting. But we were talking about patents. We were talking about suits. And obviously the patent system gets abused. It gets abused by patent trolls. But then right now we have so many patents being filed on everything. It's becoming a major barrier to entry for any new players.
Yes. It's actually really difficult for anyone to keep up on these patents. And it's no surprise that patents end up getting contested, because how can the patent office even hope to try and keep up with the flood of filings that they get?
Yeah. Yeah. So in the meanwhile, Apple won.
Oh, my God, I totally forgot that was our topic.
Apple was found not guilty. The jury was asked to decide if iTunes 6 compared to iTunes 7, if iTunes 7 represented genuine improvements, product improvements, or if it was... the only reason it was released was to lock real networks out of the iPod.
Right. And it seems that the jury felt that it was innovation, not just Apple being jerks.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the things, the plaintiffs did not want the real networks lockout to be lumped in with the other general improvements. They actually wanted that considered separately. And the judge didn't allow it. The judge have the jury look at iTunes 6 to iTunes 7 as a whole.
Right. Which seems, in this case, based on what I know, that seems like a reasonable...
Yeah, it is. I'm very pleased at the results of this. I mean, don't get me wrong. There is no doubt to me that Apple was very much looking to use the DRM it was required to have by the labels as not only a means of quality control. Like if they were going to have DRM, they were going to go ahead and use it to their fullest extent to make it as best possible for Apple. And, these things definitely go hand in hand. It's probably separating would be like separating the peanut butter from the jelly. Apple used DRM restrictions for its best results.
Well, considering Apple was pushed into DRM because they didn't want to copy protect songs in the beginning. Once they were pushed into that, they might as well use it to their best advantage.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the thing that Apple does so well is to give us a great experience. And quite frankly, having other people mucking about with the Fairplay database is not going to result in a great experience for some users. And this is, you know, this is part and parcel of having the walled garden. This is part and parcel of having the whole widget business model. And I don't blame Apple for locking Real out. You know, Real Networks would have been far better served by putting the energy they spent in trying to hack their way into Fairplay compatibility by instead convincing the labels to drop DRM. Because then Real Networks could have sold songs and people could have put them on their iPods.
Just like Amazon does. Just like today.
Right. Just like Amazon does today, just like Google does today, just like iTunes does today.
Yes. And oh, geez, you can go to the Amazon Music Store, purchase songs, and the little utility they have, the app for your computer to facilitate the purchase process, takes the music and puts it into your iTunes library for you. While the interface that they have through the website for making purchases, I don't think is the most elegant. The process they have, once you've installed their little app for buying and then getting that content into iTunes, I mean, it's pretty slick. You just make your purchases and this app handles the download and the transfer. I mean,
if Amazon sold lossless files, I might even buy from them.
I mean, I have bought some stuff from them, like when I can get a crazy, stupid deal on an album, like an album I'm interested in for $1.99, and it's MP3.
Right.
If I find that I really like the music that much, okay, then I'll rebuy it somewhere else.
Speaking of Amazon,
but it's simple and it works.
Speaking of Amazon. Amazon got kind of a shellacking in court this week. Kind of.
And no, that's not code.
It's really interesting because we had Apple's hearing in its ongoing appeal for antitrust violations in the iBooks, ebooks market. Mm-hmm. And To bring everybody up to speed, Apple was convicted for being the ringleader of a conspiracy to fix prices, to enter into a horizontal price-fixing agreement with publishers. Apple was the ringleader, says Judge Cote.
You know, the way Judge Cote presented her image of Apple as the ringleader and all the publishers as the co-conspirators, I always get stuck in my head the image from the Batman movie, not the Christopher Nolan movies, but the first Batman movie with Adam West and Burt Ward. And when they go to the lair where you have Joker and Penguin and Riddler and Catwoman all together, That's the scene that I have in my head. Well, thank you, Judge.
Who are you casting in the role of Batman and Robin? Is that like the DOJ and Amazon?
Yes.
Is Apple the Joker?
Yeah. Because the Joker was always the ringleader, and so you have the ringleader, and then all the henchmen.
Yeah, I'm not comfortable with this analogy you're crafting for us, sir.
Okay, no, this is not an analogy. This is an image in my head of the way I see Judge Cote viewing all of this.
I'm not comfortable with this, sir.
Hey, at least everyone was wearing clothes, okay?
I'm so punchy. I had so little sleep last night. I'm punchy. All right, so we had the hearing.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
It's true. Well played. So, hearing. So Apple has appealed its conviction. So Apple, you know, the five publishers all settled, A, because they didn't want to fight, and B, probably because they knew that they were, in fact, in a conspiracy to fix prices. But, you know, that's just nitpicking. see, but that's the thing, though, is the DOJ's own guidelines. I wrote about this about a year ago. I think I just bumped the microphone, too. The DOJ's own guidelines say that horizontal price fixing is allowed for new entrants into a market controlled by a monopolist.
And yet, we ended up with this case in court before Judge
Cote. And the publishers all settled. You know, the publishers all settled. I wish they hadn't. I wonder what's going to happen. I wonder if... All right, well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. So
I think I know where you were going, and I'm okay getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. So if the appeals court overturns Judge Cote's ruling, the restrictions that have been put in place as far as who can negotiate and how those negotiations can take place for deals, that all goes away.
Well, that's not where I was going, funny enough, because those restrictions are already lapsing now.
That's true.
The whole point of this, where I was going to go was, I wonder what this will mean in hindsight for the publishers having already settled. If Apple, of course, the reality is that Apple is arguing in front of the appellate court. So it was a district judge, a federal judge in a district court, Denise Cote, who convicted Apple. So Apple appeals. It goes to a circuit court. Circuit court has, I don't know, what, 5 or 7 judges? Does that sound right?
I think it's 5. I think
it might be 7. So actually, it may depend on the circuit. But what happens is a subset, usually in most appeals, a subset of judges hears a particular appeal.
Which is what happened in this
case. Right, three judges. Judge Lohier, Judge Jacobs, and Judge Jingleheimer Schmidt.
Somehow I knew you were going to throw in a made-up name like that for the third judge.
I can't
judge.
Remember her name. I'm sorry, I don't remember her name. So if I'm ever in front of your bench judge, I apologize in advance. So they heard Apple's appeal, and Apple argued that Judge Cote used the wrong standard to convict Apple. She used the per se illegal standard, which means that price fixing is illegal, the end. Essentially, that's what it means. In this case, I should say. That's what
that
means.
Yeah, okay. In this case, that's what it means.
It means that price fixing is illegal, so Apple was the publishers were engaged in price fixing, and Apple was engaged in price fixing. Therefore, Apple is guilty of antitrust violations, pretty much the end of the story. Which, by the way, is pretty much what she did. You know, she ignored all of the testimony. She just dismissed it as lacking credibility. All of the testimony from Apple that disproved the DOJ's case. And pretty much said that the publishers were involved in a price-fixing scheme. And Apple was the ringleader at the end.
Yep. That's pretty much exactly what she did. It didn't matter what Apple said, what witnesses they put on the stand. I think it matters now, because it sure looks like two of the three judges that sat on the appeals panel were sympathetic to Apple's arguments.
Indeed. So Apple was arguing that she should instead have used the rule of reason standard, which essentially means, hey, doofus, apply a little logic to this situation and don't be so literal. I think attorneys might put it differently.
They might. At least when they're in front of the bench. It's
true. And so in this case, what that would mean is looking at the fact that while there was a horizontal price-fixing scheme, that the market was controlled by a monopolist, which is Amazon. Amazon had 90% of the ebook market at the time. 90%. That's monopoly power by any standard.
Yes. And if you were abusing that power, which it appears that Amazon may have been.
Amazon was Apple dumping bestsellers. They were dumping bestsellers to extend and maintain their monopoly.
Yes. Yep. There you go. Yeah. That's
and look at the results. There were no other competing ebook platforms. There was the Nook, but the Nook has always struggled, but the Nook continued to struggle. As a matter of fact, Barnes & Noble's Nook didn't take off until Apple and the publishers changed the rules.
Which totally plays into the DOJ's own guidelines.
Yes. It does, because Apple brought competition to the market. Apple brought competition to the ebook market. I know that we've talked about this. This drives me nuts because I don't get it. I don't get how a rational person can look at what happened in the ebook market and convict Apple of antitrust violations. Why was Apple even being sued in the first place?
You know, this all goes back to my notion that the DOJ needed a scapegoat because they needed to create or they needed to reinstill in people the notion that they have some power and some authority.
They're going to regulate businesses,
right?
Because business so that was largely abrogated by the previous administration, just as a practical effect of the different philosophies on how to govern.
Right, so they went for a high-profile case to use as an example.
Yeah, so why not go after the monopolist who's dumping books? Amazon was dumping books, and they were dumping books to extend and maintain their monopoly, which is an express violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. I mean, goodness gracious, it is so befuddling. And Apple's actions by bringing this horizontal price fixing scheme, which they did. Yeah, Apple armed the publishers with the weapons the publishers needed to force Amazon into a new the agency pricing model, right? Mm-hmm. So Apple, I mean, there was in fact this horizontal price fixing scheme, but here's the reality. The reality is that it opened up competition in e-readers for the first time. And while bestsellers rose in price, the average price of ebooks fell. So you've got
How about that? You've got
more competition. You have the average price of ebooks falling, and you have some bestsellers. Most bestsellers definitely increased from $9.99 at Amazon to $12 and $13.99 at Amazon and iBooks and Nook and Kobo. And a couple of attempts at the publishers to have their own ebook platform. And how about that? We suddenly have competition. And we have competition on experience. And not only that, this is an important thing. One of the reasons why Apple did all this is because the publishers were not allowing all of their books to be ebooks. They didn't want to because they were concerned about the price erosion from Amazon's dumping in hurting their print sales. So Apple's deal was, how about this? How about we go to agency model? You get to rein Amazon back under your control, and in return, you bring all your books to iBooks and Kindle and everything else.
And since the publishers had wanted to move to an agency model anyhow, they were like, all right, let's give it a shot.
So consumers got all kinds of benefits from this, while the one negative was paying what bestsellers are actually supposed to cost.
Yeah, so in certain situations, they were paying a couple dollars more for books, but overall, they were not seeing a price increase.
Correct. And yet, the publishers were sued, Apple was sued, publishers settled, and Apple was convicted. So now we get to the hearing. And as Jeff already said, two of the three judges, one judge in particular was pretty vociferous in his questioning. He referred to Amazon as a monopolist. Actually, both judges did. Judge Lahir and Judge Jacobs both referred to Amazon as a monopolist. Judge Jacobs also used the term predatory pricing to refer to Amazon.
Pretty strong words coming from the bench.
Yes, very strong words indeed. And he also, he questioned why the case was brought against Apple in the first place. He made jokes at the DOJ's expense. Never a good sign. Never, ever a good sign when a judge is making fun of you.
No. Not a good sign at all.
And, you know, we talked about this a little bit on TDO, and I wrote about this too. It is always dangerous, very, very dangerous to reach conclusions based on a judge's commentary in an appeals case or a case in front of the Supreme Court.
That's true, because there are various reasons why a judge may suddenly start grilling you. And as you've said, it could be because they are trying to establish whether or not your arguments are waterproof, or they could be looking for other types of issues. But yeah, there's a lot of different reasons why they may pick on specific points in a case, and it isn't necessarily because they're trying to shoot the case down.
Yeah, they may be trying to head off, like they know that another judge thinks differently about a case, and so they want to head off any potential criticisms by just directly attacking them.
Right, and so they ask those questions, they get the answers, that's now part of the court record, and there you go, it's established.
Yeah, and by the way, these appeals cases work, you don't have new evidence. You don't have new testimony that's introduced into the case. What you have is a review of the existing testimony, the existing evidence, and then you have arguments, short arguments, like 10, 20 minutes at the most, right?
Right. Yeah, like the appeal in this case was a day.
It was an 80-minute hearing.
Yeah, so that's it.
So you have 10 or 20 minutes on the side, and then you have... then you have the judges asking questions of both sides, or of one side and or the other side, I should say. They don't have to ask questions.
Right. If they don't ask any questions, I would be really nervous.
Yeah, it's true. So that's the way it works at the Supreme Court. That's the way it works at the appellate court. Supreme Court, I think you get an hour to present your case. Both sides get an hour, and then... the judges may or may not ask questions, but at the appellate level, it's a little bit shorter. So there was no new testimony introduced, nothing like that. The hearing is over; it's done. Now we only have to await the judge's decision. It could take as long as 6 months. But it's always risky reaching conclusions based on those questions. But it really did seem like two of the judges were doubtful of the government's case against Apple in the first place, let alone the way the Judge Coate decided the case.
Sure. And then the third judge was not adamantly against Apple's arguments, but did seem more sympathetic than the other judges to the DOJ side.
Right. And we're basing that on mainstream coverage. Fortune had Philip Elmore DeWitt, who's been a guest on the show, talking about this the same case, actually.
That's right. It was this very case.
When it was, before it was decided. And the AP had someone there, and the AFP had someone there. And it was, we're talking about based on their coverage of the hearing. But so this third judge apparently was more sympathetic towards, seemingly more sympathetic towards the government's case than the other two judges. But Judge Jacobs in particular was really, really vociferous. I would imagine that we're going to have a 2-1 decision.
That seems very plausible.
And it just remains to be seen which side Judge Jacobs is on. That's my guess.
Yeah, so what it's looking like to me is that we will have at least a 2-1 decision in favor of Apple.
Yes. Yeah, that is what I am hoping. And of course, at that point, the DOJ, the loser can appeal to the Supreme Court.
Right. And so assuming the case gets tossed out, or meaning Judge Coates' verdict gets tossed out, and that's the end of it, then it will be interesting to see if the DOJ decides it's worth the money to pursue this at the Supreme Court level.
Yeah, if it's worth the potential of getting beat in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's that will not be a feather in Eric Holder's cap.
No, and they've already spent gobs of money on this case.
Well, sure. That's what the DOJ, I mean, you know, it does cost money. The DOJ costs money.
It does.
Yeah. I don't really think that they actually think of it in terms of resources, because it's not a for-profit entity.
No, but the resources needed to take a case all the way to the Supreme Court is something that is taken into consideration.
Yeah, 100%. If Apple loses this appeal, 100% chance that Apple appeals to the Supreme Court. I would put it at 90% chance that the DOJ appeals if the DOJ loses.
I think that you are overestimating that. I think it's more like a 70% chance.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Because at this point, I think it really comes down to two things for the DOJ. Do they want to pump resources into the case still, or will those resources be better used in other cases?
Yeah, and the Supreme Court is, this particular Supreme Court is, to be politically polite, very business friendly. Favor Apple on this particular issue. Because you know there's a whole bunch of other stuff that we haven't even talked about. The fact that the agency model is not something that Apple invented in the first place. I mean, you know, everything that Apple was doing was pretty much business as usual for Apple, but it's also business as usual in plenty of other industries too.
Right.
So yeah it's. I don't know. We'll see. I think another factor in it going to the Supreme Court will be if it's a 2-1 decision or a 3-0 decision.
Sure.
If it's 2-1, the loser will likely seize on the opinion of the one to bolster its arguments for taking it to the Supreme Court.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah.
All right. Well, we will see what happened. I tell you, man, I was extraordinarily gratified to see Judge Jacobs seemingly looking at this case the way I've been looking at it, and not as a pat on the back thing, but as a my mind has been blown by this whole case the whole time. Anyway, it's like it's really. I mean, Judge Coates, she's just so wrong on this stuff. It was nice to see what I think of as reason applied to the case in the questioning.
Yes, and I was really wondering about some of the perspective that the DOJ had going into this, like comparing Apple to drug runners.
Yeah, that was one of the jokes that Judge Jacobs made. He said that the narcotics industry was one of those industries where the government tends not to look kindly on new entrants to the market.
Right. I mean, it was as if the DOJ intentionally leaned into the curveball.
True. It is true. All right, we should probably move on to our next topic. Actually, you know what? The Twitter tweet.
Oh yeah, the Twitter Tweety box thing.
Yeah, that thing.
You
where the
do
people,
that, don't you?
That I do that. I do that at TM O'Brien. It's Brian with a Y.
Yes, and you offer up fun little insights about the industry and what you're doing with your writing projects.
Yep, sometimes a little politics, mm-hmm. And I make no apologies for that. If you aren't interested in politics or not interested in my politics, I'm totally okay with that.
Sure. Yeah, the important thing to remember is that our Twitter accounts are our Twitter accounts, so we can say whatever we want, just like you can say whatever you want.
Absolutely,
to.
Absolutely. And you are on Twitter.
I am. I am Jay Gamut on Twitter.
So, you know, follow us.
Yeah, because we're more than happy to chat with you.
Yeah, we are. We interact with, I think at this point, we interact with our listeners through Twitter more than, definitely more than email. Not actually, it's not even close. Yeah, we interact with our listeners and our readers, but particularly our listeners quite a bit on the yeah. Twitter tweet.
Yeah, and it's great because it gives all of us a fairly immediate interaction with each other.
Indeed, yeah, it is. It is. It's very cool. Even when we're getting yelled at for noise.
Yeah.
I'm still sorry. Apologizer in chief.
Well, now we know. The interns are louder than we thought.
You know who else is louder than we thought? You know, I'm just phoning these things in anymore. we had some. We learned today that the first. Watchmaker, the first luxury watchmaker, the first timepiece maker, first Swiss watchmaker to admit that they're working on a smartwatch unveiled some new details.
Do you think admit is a fair word to use? Because that's kind of loaded in this case.
Well, yeah, I do think, because here's the thing. I think that, all right, let's just jump right into it. LVMH is an umbrella corporation. It's a luxury brand company. They own lots of luxury brands like Louis Vuitton and a whole bunch of other brands, and none of which I can remember because I'm just way, way too sleepy today. They also own several watch brands, the three most prominent of which are Tag Heuer, Heuer, right? I guess most people call it Heuer. Tag Heuer.
I don't wear watches, and so I've always just assumed it was like Tag Heuer.
Tag. Let's call him Tag.
Let's call him Tag.
The most prominent brands are Tag, Hublot, and Zenith. Probably in that order, because Tag is their entry level company. They sell watches in the like the $600 to $5,000 range. And most of their watches are in the, you know, like the $2,000 range.
So that tells you a lot about the high-end luxury watch market when the entry level is $600 to $5,000.
Right. And that truly is the entry level of the fine timepiece market. Movado, Tag, those are probably the two of the best-known brands. And that's where they compete. They're entry-level watches. Hublot is like the $6,000 to $100,000 range, but they've got a lot of watches in that $10,000 to $20,000-$30,000 range. And Zenith is also actually, there's a little bit of overlap, not stylistically, but price wise, there's a little bit of overlap, and they do roughly $6,000 to $100,000 watches too. Most of their watches are going to be in that ten to twenty range, maybe even 9 to 20. We'll mm-hmm. call it. So. But then you've got Swatch, and Swatch is much more than just Swatch. Swatch owns like everybody. They've got like 20 different brands. They own, I'm looking at Swatch brands. Companies and brand, the Swatch Group. It's a good thing, by the way, that I did all this research before we started recording.
I know. Did you ever do Swatch Time?
I tried. We actually tried to do that on TMO.
No kidding. That would have been before I was on board.
Long before. It would have been, 1999, actually, is when we tried to do that. Dave thought I was an idiot, and he was probably right. But I like the idea of metric time.
I thought it was a cool idea, and I installed an extension for OS 8 or OS 9.
I did too.
At the time. And I found I was the only person I knew.
Oh, if only we had connected.
If only we connected, we could ask each other what time it was. I know.
Exactly. It's 720 beats right now, and it's about to change to 721 because I am also using the Swatch time, and I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it's just really exciting, and it's just amazing how we can be synchronized over the internet like that.
So Swatch owns the Swatch brand. They own the Rado brand. They own the Tissot brand. They own the Blancpain brand. Glashütte Original, which is actually a German watch company. Jacquet Rose, Harry Winston, any of these names? Brigeot, any of these Longines?
You lost me after Swatch.
How about Omega? Or Omega, Omega. As Daniel Craig says it. Omega.
Omega. Isn't Omega the company that made the watches that the astronauts wore on the Apollo missions to the moon?
Yes.
Okay, see? There you go. I know a watch company.
Using, I believe, I want to say, and I could be wrong, using that movement I've told you about that's in my watch.
Okay.
Whatever. That's a Zenith watch, which is one of the companies owned by LVMH. Hamilton, you might have heard of them. You might have also heard of a little outfit called Calvin Klein. They make watches too, whatever. So, Swatch has all these brands. They're a much larger company when it comes to watches. And I would say there is a 0% chance that somewhere within one of these brands that they own, they're not working on a smartwatch or two.
So I just realized this is the single longest lead up to an answer you have ever given me on the show.
Is that actually true, though?
I'm pretty sure. I think this has been almost 10 minutes of a lead up to you saying, yes, it's fair
no.
to say that they admitted.
We started this conversation 5 minutes ago.
It sure feels longer than that.
Uh-oh. Oops. So the question was, is admit a fair word? And I think it is. I think that there is zero chance that Swatch and LVMH are not working on a smartwatch. It wouldn't surprise me if Rolex, Breitling, Panera,
the Lord. Sandwich people.
Not
they're making a smart sandwich. Not only can you eat it, but you can choose what cheese you want on it, and it does beats time.
Panerai. Can't believe I did that. Oh my God, I'm so amused at myself for getting that wrong. Panera. All right. Anyway, I think that I would also assume, by the way, that Seiko, a Japanese company, is working on a smartwatch. So in the Swiss luxury brand area, first company to admit that they're doing it. And what they announced is that they have taken on technology partners and are considering making acquisitions in the technology world to facilitate bringing a smartwatch to market. And they let us know that the smartwatch would be a mechanical watch that has health and fitness sensors as well as smartwatch functionality. So kind of a hybrid device between a mechanical watch and a smartwatch.
Which sounds very interesting.
It is very interesting. I think, in fact, I honestly believe that they can have some success with this. And I think some other brands could have some success with this too. I'm personally not all that interested in the Tag brand, but
a lot of people are.
A lot of people think Tag is a nice fancy watch. Tag is because it competes at the entry level. They sell a lot more. I mean, orders of magnitude more watches than Zenith sells or Hublot. You know, both of those companies are relatively obscure, especially to mainstream users, the kind of people that might say be interested in an Apple Watch.
Sure. Yeah, people like me.
Yeah.
Yeah, to me, Zenith has always been a company that made vacuum tube televisions.
Right. Once upon a time, they were the same company. Decades ago, I think in the 30s, they separated. And the Zenith Electronics Company became a U.S. company that was not owned by the Zenith Watch Company, but the Zenith Watch Company was first.
Okay.
So the electronics business split from that. And in fact, the Zenith brand has changed hands numerous times. There is no more Zenith company. There is a Zenith company, but it's owned by LVMH. It's controlled by the same guy that controls TAG and Ublo, et cetera.
Isn't it interesting how companies like that started off as one thing, but they're known for something else?
Yeah.
Like Volvo is another good example. They made ball bearings, decided to make cars as a side business.
Mitsubishi. Made airplanes.
See?
All right. Fine. They were zeros.
but they were airplanes.
They were airplanes. Now they're known mostly for cars. So, covering all this business from TAG, I put my finger on something I've been searching for a long time. And I was thinking about how Jean-Claude Biver, who is this watch guy at the LVMH.
Leave it to Biver.
How he was very dismissive of the Apple Watch when it first came out. He called it too feminine, which I actually think is, like, he's dead wrong on. And he said that it wasn't sexy and that it looked like a first semester, first trimester, I think is what he said. Student who was learning how to be a watchmaker is what he meant, had designed it, which I also disagree with. But it occurred to me when I was rereading over those comments came out back in September, and it occurred to me that the folks, and we're largely talking about men here, but the men who control the luxury watch market are so steeped in the traditional watch market, they might not understand that Apple doesn't care about them. They see smartwatch and they assume that Apple's coming after their market. And Apple is not. I don't think Apple gives a rat's behind about the luxury watch market.
No, Apple is coming after me. But since it's all about you, Apple is coming after your friend, Jeff.
that's so outstanding in so many different ways. Apple is selling the Apple Watch at the nexus of jewelry, technology, and health and fitness. And that's not a nexus where the traditional Swiss watch industry exists.
No, if it did, I would probably know a lot more about the high-end Swiss watch market.
And I think that they probably don't get that, and they don't understand that Apple isn't going to be marketing the Apple Watch to their customers. Yes, of course, some people who currently buy watches are people that Apple would like to have buy Apple Watches, and in particular, maybe even buy the rose gold or gold one at the $5,000 level, but Apple isn't going to be marketing to them in the same way. You know, Apple is looking at the Apple Watch as a piece of, oh my goodness, it's functional art.
Huh. Well, there you go. Yeah. And they're looking for people that aren't going to be swapping out their watches. Which comes back to me. If I were to get an Apple Watch, it would be the only thing I wear on my wrist, as
sure.
opposed to you or Dave or other people that are really into the high-end timepieces, where you want more than one, so that you can collect them. You can wear different watches for different things.
Yeah, but see, that's... You're hitting on such an interesting spot for me. Because if I buy into the Apple Watch, by buy into it, I mean mentally.
Okay.
And I'm buying into, say, the health and fitness related activities. I'm buying into the reality that I'm going to get my directions by getting taps on the wrist instead of looking at a screen. Right? Mm-hmm. That I'm doing Apple Pay with my watch. You know, if I'm buying into this stuff, especially the fitness tracking, when would I wear another watch?
Right. When would you wear another watch? Exactly.
Now, Apple has made the Apple Watch interchangeable with bands, trying to, I think, to address that same part of what you're saying. Again, not thinking of it in terms of the way watchmakers have thought about it, but actually thinking of it in terms of fashion. So you want to change your watch, you don't change your watch, you change your band.
Right.
I mean, this is explicit from Apple. I mean, the Apple Watch was intentionally, specifically, and explicitly designed for you to be able to change the band on a whim. And, you know, Apple is hoping that you will, in fact, buy multiple bands.
And it makes sense that a lot of people will. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they sure showed off a lot of bands when they introduced Apple Watch.
Yeah, you know, if you're active, you'd probably at least want to have a band for being active and a different band for a night on the town. Yeah.
Yep.
At least two bands.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm wondering what happens. You know, and this is the area that I've wondered if Apple will have a significant impact on the luxury watch market, not because Apple is competing with them, but because they're both competing for the same space, which is the wrist top.
You know, I have a feeling Apple's going to have a much bigger impact on the mid-range watch market.
That is entirely possible in the entry level too, actually.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Entry and mid-range. Absolutely. Yeah. Because those are the people that more than likely fall into the same general demographic that I am. Someone that doesn't wear a watch or wears one casually, or they just have their Timex or you know, something else that's $100 or less that they wear, and it's fine. But this will suddenly be the amazing, cool wrist top technology, fashion statement, art piece thing that they fall in love with.
Right.
So it's companies like Timex and Casio that are going to take the bigger hit.
Kat, you know, I'm not so sure about that, simply because of the price differential. People that are buying a Timex are like, you know, oftentimes people who are like, I'm not spending $40 on a watch. So I don't know how many Timex owners would spend $350 for an Apple Watch Sport.
Okay, that shows you just how long it's been since I bought a watch.
Watches are cheap. There are a lot of really cheap watches. Yes, there are a lot of ridiculously, obscenely expensive watches, for sure. But there are, I mean, you could buy a quartz watch for, you know, a couple of bucks, and it's going to keep amazing time.
Okay. And I was assuming that that just a nice entry-level watch was going to cost you like $75. But I need to drop that substantially down to like $10.
I haven't. All right, so let's go to my friends at Amazon and look up Timex watch. 27/31, 25/31, 25/26, 16/16, 50/60, 16/37/31.
So we're looking at watches at the entry level around $15 to $20.
Yeah, I think Swatch watches are probably a little more expensive than that.
Wow.
Let's check Swatches. Swatches 80, 120, 40, 50, 62. Yep, a little more expensive.
Okay.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
You know, it's also interesting. It's interesting that Apple is Apple's task is to get a new generation. I said this on TDO. I'm going to say it again because I'm still exploring the idea in my head. Apple's job is to convince a new generation, maybe two new generations of people to consider their wrist. And at the exact same time, Apple is forcing, I'm saying it differently than I said on TDO. Apple is forcing the existing watch market to reconsider the wrist. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, well, this is what Apple does. They move into a market that other companies are already in, and they bring a completely different spin to whatever that is. And then the companies that are already established in that market react and start mimicking, on some level, what Apple is doing.
Mm-hmm. All right, there you have it. We're over time.
Yeah, it's amazing how that happens. Like, every single time. Almost. Yeah. Okay, and that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com, and thanks for listening.
Let's see here. Our content is written by the good people. I still don't get that right. At the Mac Observer, our bandwidth is provided by CashFly, the basis by Boom Recorded, just for us, and that's all for this week.
And as always, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.
You know, you probably would have had better luck with the script if I had fixed it properly for you. Just saying.